Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and today's conversation is with Dick Strasser, Chief Financial Officer and Executive Vice President of the United States Postal Service. Joining us in our conversation is another PwC partner, Bill Takis.
Now, Dick, besides the FAA, the Postal Service has probably been the agency that's been most affected by the effects of 9/11 and anthrax. Can you tell us a little bit about how the agency has responded to both of those impacts on the country?
Yes, Bill. Actually, you're right. It was a real jolt. 9/11 was a large enough challenge in the sense that the nation's air transportation system, upon which we depend for a lot of our transport of our mail, was affected. But the anthrax was even more so when we lost two of our employees, and it was a very unfortunate situation. What's occurred since then is we've been very, very focused primarily on the safety and security of the mail, safety of our employees, number one, and then the security of the mail, and reinstilling the confidence in the mail system on the part of the public. I think the biggest challenge, and of course, I think it's been to some degree overcome by the confluence of education and communication, has been the unknown, the anthrax being so unknown, being invisible initially, and striking so hard before we ever had the opportunity to begin to understand it. We are well on our way to development of plans. As you know, at this point, we are irradiating government mail, the zip codes that are encompassed by the first three digits, 202 to 205. We are not irradiating other mail at this point in time. We are developing a plan that will, first of all, detect biochemical agents in the mail stream, and will enable us to short circuit that what happened with the anthrax that was mailed in Trenton, which was that it flowed downstream to other facilities and then got to other people's offices. So we are putting together a plan for the initial expenditure of $500 million, which Congress has appropriated for the security of the mail and the safety of the mail stream. And we hope to have that filed with the congressional committees in the coming couple of weeks so that we can proceed forward with that initial introduction of detection and methods of containing any future occurrence with regard to biochemicals in the mail stream or biohazards in the mail stream. We've recovered from that. I think we've generally provided, for example, our inspection service has provided security assistance to major mailing industry partners so that they can also have benefit of the expertise that we have as it relates to mail safety and security. But it definitely was a situation. It's one of those disconnects that was always said to be coming at us in the 21st century. And it, while life happens, who said it, life happens while you're making plans, good plans for other things. And it was quite an experience, which I think we've come around and gotten on top of at this point.
How have the events of 9/11 and anthrax affected the financial situation of the Postal Service?
It threw a cross-body block on us as well as others in the industry, in the mailing industry. The initial collective pause of virtually everyone in the nation after 9/11 caused volumes to tumble for the first four-week period by in the order of about 8%, which is very, very significant. Since then, it's been difficult to differentiate the terrorist acts from the recession in terms of mail volume. All I can tell you is at this point, for the first 5 months of this fiscal year, we're looking at a 5% reduction in mail volume compared to the same period last year, which is virtually unprecedented certainly in the 30 years of the Postal Service.
What strategies are being employed to cover costs and meet the revenue shortfall?
We've actually employed significant strategies even before the shortfall in volume occurred. Last year and for 2 years, we've been employing a breakthrough productivity model, which is based on best practices and spreading best practices across across our operations, both in the processing centers and in delivery units. In addition to that, we have a tremendous piece of equipment we call an automated flat sorter 100, which we're deploying throughout the nation, and its throughputs and capacities have exceeded our expectations, and we've been able to reduce the amount of work hours taken to sort flats. The overall combination of these things has enabled us to reduce our career employment by 21,000 individuals in the last 18 months. And we do that through attrition, which we think is the better side of things. So often in the private sector, when they do shed people, they have to book the cost of that restructuring, and it's substantial cost. So far, we've been able to essentially restructure to the tune of 21,000 career employees, looking for probably another 10,000 the remainder of this fiscal year, without incurring a restructuring cost in that respect.
Does managing it through attrition, is that the most effective way to reduce staff?
We think it makes sense in terms of the people impact. Definitely, and as long as we are able to sustain it, it seems to be the most reasonable approach to it. If we end up in situations where, for example, we've got some administrative situations in reducing our areas by 20% and cutting 800 positions out of headquarters, unfortunately, in those cases, there may be some very small reductions in force that will have to be employed.
How is the balance done between meeting service levels and reducing staff? It sounds like in the example of the flat sorter, technology enables that to take place. Is that true elsewhere as well?
We're pleased to say, with the exception of the transportation-related setbacks we had in service, we've been able to sustain the very high levels of service we've attained in the last 5 or 6 years, which have been, prior to that, unprecedented. That is not a balance that we talk about doing both, essentially. We want to retain the high levels of service for all of the services we offer, and at the same time, as you say, substitute capital for labor costs and become more efficient at the same time.
We've talked about using technology to improve effectiveness and efficiency, and recently your duties were expanded to include the oversight of the Postal Service's Information Technology Group. Could you tell us why this change was made?
Well, actually, it seemed to be a pretty good fit, in the sense that with limited resources, you know, we need to invest in information in the IT function. And of course, the IT function, with the way it changes and accelerates in terms of technology year over year, it can get to be a substantial investment for an organization our size. We have, of course, revenue stream of $65 billion, and we have numerous locations. We have, for example, we have an associate office infrastructure that spreads to 8,000 of our facilities. And then we use a VSAT capability for another 7,000 of our facilities. So we have 15,000 of our facilities that are tied on our network to a central network. And updating that network, as well as integrating it across functions with the shared data concepts and the shared applications, is a very important concept. And I guess what we've done here is we've established portfolio managers in the IT function, so that they can assist in the integration of these types of future applications that we find will enhance our effectiveness through the entire process. We've got huge efforts in supply chain management. We've got efforts in human capital enterprise we're about to begin, which would be the concept of hire to retire and the entire flow of data and information and payroll and things of that nature. So they're very large enterprise-wide systems that we're attempting to first design through an architecture and then implement in the coming years, that will gain tremendous tremendous efficiencies. We have, for example, on an e-travel basis, we have a paperless voucher system that makes automatic payments of the Visa card, the GSA Visa card, as well as automatic payments to an individual's bank account for the residual that's due to the individual. And we have 30,000 employees on that system right now. So we're taking paper out of our processes continuously.
The e-travel one sounds very interesting. I'm just curious, at the time the people introduced the business case for that, was it easy to see the benefits? Because I've often wondered how it really worked, that technology, a spend is introduced by promising benefits in the future and spending money now. And I've often wondered how that was really assessed and a decision made.
Well, it was interesting. I came back into headquarters from my previous position as district manager in Northern Virginia while the pilot was just about to be launched. And I found it interesting. The program managers decided to do it with the officers of the organization first. And that was a risky proposition, but what ended up happening is they ended up showing that even officers can do it, and it set the tone, I think, because we saw the benefits of the reduction of paper and the Visa, for example. All your Visa bills are imported into the system automatically, and it's just a tremendous leap forward with what was essentially not a uniquely developed software package. It was a software package off the shelf that was modified just a little bit.
Well, that's a good stopping point. Rejoin us in a few minutes as we continue our discussion with Dick Strasser of the Postal Service. Did you ever wonder why stamp prices go up? We'll ask Dick to explain the rate setting process when the Business of Government Hour continues.